Today is August 26, 2013. This is Desiree Hargis on behalf of the H.J. Lucher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports. As part of the 1968 U.S. Olympic Team Legacy Archive, I am interviewing Dean Williford over the phone about his experiences in the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. Dean, first of all, did I pronounce your last name correctly?
Williford, yes.
Okay. Can you begin with when and where you were born and tell me a little bit about where you grew up?
Born in 1944, born in Dallas, Texas. I moved out to Southern California with my mom when I was about 11 or so, to Southern California. And really started, always liked athletics. And when I was about 12, I accidentally went into a swimming class, I guess, and wound up on a little swimming team, and my athletic career went from there.
Can you summarize some of the highlights in your athletic career leading up to the 68 trials?
Sure. How far back do you think you'd like to go?
All the way back.
Okay, well, about 12 or so, as I mentioned, I ran into a friend. He was a member of a swim team, and it was a hot day, so I went with him to go swimming. And I met the coach, and of course, it was just rough, but I knew how to swim, and I liked it there, and it was a nice environment. I'm from a single mother home, and it shortly became kind of a second place to go, you know, three or four blocks from my house. And then it gradually improved, and within about a year or so, I was doing competitive swimming. And I'm just trying to think. I think I won my first trophy. I got it sitting right here, as a matter of fact, as a second place in 1959 in breaststroke, which is my worst stroke. But anyway, then, of course, it was just a series of many, many things. I think when I was about 13 or so, a major breakthrough was I got to be the second fastest mile swimmer in that year. At the age of 13, and that was, I guess, considered pretty spectacular at that time. Then I went on to high school, and of course, high school was fun, and I was obviously one of the leading swimmers there, et cetera. Eventually, won many medals and awards in high school, and got a scholarship to University of Southern California in 1963 upon my graduation from high school, and went there for 4 years. During that time at USC, we won four national championships. I was on those teams and swam a variety of strokes and distances. And in 1964, I think I was 18, I started playing a lot of water polo because it was just more fun than swimming, looking at that line every day. And my team and I went to the trials, to the Olympic trials, and it turned out to be a three-way tie between three different teams. And eventually we had playoff, one team won, and all those team members won. They picked three or four, I guess, usually one from each competing team to go on to the Olympic Games. That was the first time that, or the last time actually, which the Olympic water polo organization did it that way. And from there on, they picked an all-star team and they trained together. And in the ensuing 4 years, from 64 to 68, we kind of pretty much trained together. And in 1967, I won the most valuable player in this country. And we went on a couple of European tours, which was fun and very educational. And so swimming and water polo have been a real blessing in my life. Got me through college, let me see the world, made many, many friends. So that gets us up to the Olympic Games that year.
Yeah, wonderful. Going back to the beginning, did you have anybody in your life that was kind of pushing you to do sports or encouraging you to do sports, your parents or siblings or friends or anything?
No, it just kind of naturally took to it. But I did have a junior high school PE teacher, a man named Mr. Bridgers, and he encouraged me a lot. I respected him a lot, and he kind of set me on the path to straight and narrow and encouraged me to work hard and go forward from there. So he was a very major influence in my life. And then once I got into swimming, my coach, Bill Sexton, who was turned out to be on high school coach later, he was very influential because he got me started and nursed me along the way until I got out of high school.
So how was your training and competition supported in, you know, during junior high school and going into college?
Well, in those days, it wasn't anywhere near as organized as it is now. There really was no money for almost anything. Anything that we did, we did go out and, in effect, bake sale stuff to raise money. I never had any money because my mom and I were together. She's a single mom. She worked hard, and of course, I spent lots of time swimming. But we would do all sorts of things. I remember in 1967, I think it was, when we wanted to go to Europe to train against other teams. We literally went door to door selling Olympic stickers for a dollar a piece. And that's how we raised money to go to the Olympic, to these training trips. When we got to 1968, it's finally when they sort of got organized, and there was a little more money then, I guess, and we went up to Colorado Springs for the first time at the Olympic training camp. That's when it started. And I guess it's subsequently become kind of the central site for all that.
Mm-hmm. So did you have any heroes or swimmers or water polos that you looked up to in high school or college?
Well, actually, yes. At that time, there were a couple of Australian swimmers who were world record holders. And I remember carrying around a small newspaper clip of one of them when I was 13 or 14. He was kind of, someone to try to emulate. And guys like Murray Rose, a couple others, who were 5 to 7 years older than I was. So they were 20 and I was 14. So I looked up to them. Mm-hmm. That's really what went further. I had a couple of guys who I wound up playing with who, at the time I got involved in water polo, where I was the kid on the team, and they went to the 1960 Olympic Games. So they were all in their mid-20s when I matured in by 64 to 68, and I looked up to them too.
Mm. So can you describe the Olympic trials in 1968 and the process and any challenges you had to overcome there?
Well, by 68, as I said, we started to sort of get organized. We still played in club teams and had a national championship. We won the national championship leading up to that. Then all the players that were selected for the Nationals team were brought together early in the summer before the games, about 3 months or so, and we trained at in Palo Alto at Foothill College, and we all went up there and trained 2 times a day. Interesting enough, again, the whole thing about support and money, we had the local parents of local team members and what have you. We all stayed one or two people at their houses for a month or so. And so that was very supportive of them. But it was just, it was totally, at that time, everything really was amateur. It's not like it was now where you get paid to swim, paid to do whatever you do. You know, you had to live a life, you had to work, and you had to train all at the same time. Not trying to say that there was not, there was a rough road and all that. It's just the way it was, and it was fun.
So after you made the team, how did your friends and family and schoolmates, people that knew you, how did they react to the news that you were going to the Olympics?
Well, they were, of course, all very supportive and very congratulatory. All the people surrounding that swimming and water polo community were always helpful and you know, make you feel good about what you did. And it was just a general supportive atmosphere. And you spent more time on your training and your work than you did anything else, because you still had to support yourself and go do the training too.
Tell me a little bit about Olympic training camp in Colorado Springs and preparation for altitude in Mexico City.
Well, of course, that was the point of having it there, because it was Mexico City was 7,000 feet, and I guess Colorado was roughly that too. And that was the whole idea, is to train at altitude. We didn't do anything real special. I do remember that was one of the first times when they started to do any biometrics on athletes. In other words, started measuring your physical size, your blood work, and all that kind of thing. As a matter of fact, I got to be the one that took blood out of all of our team members that went on to be tested and what have you. It was kind of funny. But it was, once you got up there and you sort of got used to it, you figured everybody's going to be on the same playing field, so what difference does it make? You know, they don't give you points for making it tough, they just give you points for doing your job. So, from that standpoint, there really wasn't any difference. It was a great time because it formed a lot of great friendships and bonds with teammates, and of course you're away from home and all that kind of thing. I had just been married a year or so before, and so that was difficult to be almost a whole year off and on away in trips and training camp. But you got a goal, you go get it.
So you talked about relationships with U.S. teammates. Is there anybody on the U.S. team with whom you were particularly close, or anybody that you still keep in contact with today?
Well, there's a couple. A fellow by the name of Ron Crawford, who was actually turned out in the end, wound up being on three Olympic teams starting in 1960 in Rome. He was kind of one of my mentors when I was coming up. He went to the same high school I did, but he was about 6 years older, 6 or 7 years old, and some of the other people that were from local colleges, David Ashley, Bradley, and a few others. Unfortunately, we moved away from Southern California up to the Reno area, 500 miles away, and so there's not as much interaction that it used to be, but I talk with them from time to time. I'm trying to create a little something up here in Reno. The Reno community is trying to get the Winter Olympics here in the next one or two times to be centered around Squaw Valley, which is the nearest city, and of course they had Squaw Valley Olympics 1960 up here, so it would be a repeat of that. And so I'm trying to get involved in getting the businesses and other athletes here to promote that.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
So while you were in training camp for the 68 games, do you remember hearing anything about possible protests or boycotts by members of the U.S. team or track team?
No. Leading up to it, absolutely nothing. of course, once we got there and it started happening, then, of course, we found out about it. And I thought it was totally inappropriate venue for what we were doing. It was all about athletes and athletics and the amateur status, et cetera. I didn't think there was I didn't think it was an appropriate venue for, people's political beliefs. And I still don't, unfortunately. A lot of politics do bleed into athletics around the world, both professional and amateur. And I frankly thought it was inappropriate, personal, selfish, and self-indulgent.
Do you remember hearing anything about student protests and violence in Mexico City about 10 days before the start of the games?
Oh, maybe just a little blurb, but again, I was there for a different purpose. Mm-hmm. So politics, I wasn't paying any attention to.
Mm-hmm. So when you arrived in Mexico City for the games, what were your impressions of the city and its people?
Well, it was a fine city. I thought it was a terrific undertaking for them at the time to bring kind of a, at that time, sort of a third world country. I think it was one of the first ones to really try to stage something of that magnitude and organization. And I thought they did a good job having to do with that. The people were terrific. We kind of adopted a little bar not far from the Olympic Village. Got to know the people that that ran that little bar and restaurant. And our team went down there numerous times. And we had a great time. And they were terrific people to us.
What were your impressions of security measures in Mexico City?
Well, I think that was one of the first times where they got a little serious about security, not anywhere like it is nowadays, but I thought it was certainly adequate for the time and for the political climate at the time. We wore our little badges and, we had to go through a turnstile, stuff like that, but there weren't the major reason for the security was to keep the average public out of the Olympic Village. So it wasn't until 1972 when, of course, you had the terrorism at the German Games that it really changed things.
Mm-hmm. What did you think of the Olympic Village and your accommodations there?
Well, there were basic accommodations. It was kind of like student housing, so to speak. I think there were, as I recall, three or four of us to a room. We're kind of bunched together. Of course, we had the coaching staff and 11 team members and some administrative with that. So we were, as I remember, third or fourth floor or something like that. We got to meet some of the other athletes in swimming. And I thought one of the curious things that came out of the games, when everybody kind of ate at the cafeteria, of course, they had a wide variety of foods and things. And I thought it taught me a lesson about, if you could have steak every day, you thought you would, but you don't. You might do that for 2 days, and then that's it. So it was kind of a lesson of abundance. When you have what you want anytime you want, you don't do what you think you will. Whatever lesson that teaches, it made an impression on me.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. So did you or anyone you know suffer any foodborne or waterborne illnesses?
No, not. I think everything was fine. I don't recall anybody having anything like dysentery or anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Might have been the case, other teammates or whatever, but in our little group, it certainly wasn't.
Mm. What are your memories of the opening ceremony?
A big spectacular event, of course. It kind of gives you a thrill, a nervous thrill when you march in there and you have, 80,000 people yelling and screaming. And it's one of the highs of athletics, of course. And, of course, football players and baseball players or what have you have it today. And they're in those venues, and I can see why it gets them pumped up, and it gets to be sort of a little addictive quality to it.
Mm-hmm.
I can understand why a lot of, especially professional athletes who spend their whole life, at the amateur level, then go into the pros, and then when they get to their mid-30s and they finally have to retire, why it's so difficult for them to do so. And because of that addictive quality of the adulation, and obviously the money's in a lot of cases good too. But I think it's more about letting go of something that you have spent your whole life doing, and now you're going to have to change your entire life, the way you live it, who you deal with, your schedules, everything else. So that quality of it taught me some good life lessons about that.
Mm. Did you have any memorable interactions or experiences with people from other national teams?
Not really. We're more, of course, we knew a number of the people on other teams from other countries who were in our venue, but there wasn't any kind of close interaction. There was more of an acquaintance sort of thing. Because a lot of those people we've either played against or got to know over, two or three years before. So it was mostly centered around your own teammates.
Mm-hmm. 1968 being a height of the Cold War and the Vietnam War, what effect, if any, did this political climate have on interactions with teams from the Soviet bloc?
As far as I could tell, for me, none. And as far as I could tell from other teammates, et cetera, I don't recall any negative reaction. I recall stories of 1956 water polo game between Hungary and Soviet Union was literally a bloodbath. But there wasn't any of that by the 68 time rolled around.
Mm.
We were fierce rivals. And there wasn't any hurt, any hatred. It was more a respect for the quality of their play and the quality of their people.
Mm-hmm. So anything that sticks out on your mind from your competition and the final event that you were involved in, any memories that are really tangible right now to you?
Well, you always wish you did better than whatever it came out to be. I think our team got fifth that year, and I literally don't think I played as well as I could. So that was kind of a letdown. It is what it is, and you just do your best. So that's the only thing that I guess it would stick out. We just wish we did better than we did.
Mm-hmm. What about testing for banned substances and performance-enhancing substances? Do you remember anything about that in 68?
As far as I recall, I don't think there was any. I don't recall any talk about substances or steroids or, any of that kind of thing. Most of that, as I kind of recalled, came afterwards. Subsequently, there's a big stink about the German women, four and 8 years later. And then I think that was the first time that they really started measuring and testing for most things. But it didn't affect us in the least, and there wasn't any of that going on at all with the water polo venue.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned the gender thing with the German women. In 1968, gender verification testing was introduced. Did you remember hearing anything about that or overhearing any of the women talking about that?
No, not in the least.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't remember any talk about it whatsoever. We hung around a little bit with the volleyball team. They didn't say anything about it. And a little bit with the women swimmers, because we knew a lot of them. But I don't recall anything, any talk, testing, really anything to do with that.
Mm-hmm. So while you were at the games, did you get to attend or watch any other events aside from your own?
A little bit, but not much, because in the water polo venue, it kind of gets stretched out over almost the entire two-week period that you're there. Unlike a, you know, if you're running a 100-yard dash, you're basically done the third day. So we were pretty busy the entire time, but we saw a little bit of volleyball, some of the swimming. I think we went one day to the track events, but we were pretty busy almost every day.
Mm-hmm. For you personally, what was the most memorable part of competing in the Olympic Games in 68?
Well, strangely enough, I don't think it was the Olympic Games. It was the 10, 12 years that led up to it that's most memorable in my life.
Mm.
That was kind of the culmination of when you start at 12 and by the time you get to be 23 and you're at the Games, you spent more than half your life intimately involved with swimming and the water polo aspects of it, and it was kind of this was the goal. This is where we came to be, and that was the topping on the cake.
Mm-hmm.
So it was more how it formed your life rather than that one event.
Mm. What are your memories of the closing ceremony?
Well, strangely enough, my wife came down. At the time, with another wife and the team members, and stayed at a friend's house down there. And at that particular time, she told me she was pregnant with my son.
Oh.
And she went home a week early, and I went home a couple of days early and didn't attend the closing ceremonies because I was more concerned with that at the time. And I actually watched it on television.
Oh, wow. Well, that's a neat, kind of a neat story.
Well, it was a surprise, but you know, it was a surprise, and it kind of changes your thinking about what you've been doing all your life. Now you're going to be a father, and subsequently a father of two children, now grandchildren, and. So it's a real marker in your life where you change how you deal with things. As a matter of fact, it had a great deal to do. I went on to try to continue training for the 72 Olympics, and it was very difficult because trying to raise a family, trying to work, trying to train. By the time 72 rolled around, you had greater responsibilities, let me put it that way.
Yeah, for sure. Well, how are you currently participating or involved in any sports, either through participation or through governing or coaching? Are you involved in any way? Or
no, I'm not really. I had a couple of nephews who I come to find out sort of, I suppose, inspired by me, and they wound up being swimming. One of them got to be very good, and they both went to Stanford, run the Stanford swim teams, both scholarship people there. And so I kind of helped bring them along, but that's been 10 years ago now. And as I mentioned, I'm trying to get involved and trying to get the Winter Games back here to Reno and Squaw Valley area. And so that's, you know, a long process, but... just sort of getting involved in doing that. I do communicate with Tom Lau, who kind of does a newsletter for the 68 Olympic team, and I think he comes out every quarter. And I talk to him from time to time, about their reunions and that kind of thing. But I'm not really involved in sports other than being just active personally.
Mm-hmm. What one piece of advice would you give to today's Olympic hopeful?
I guess the standard stuff, you got to work hard, and you got to do your best. But if you don't, even if you don't make it, that's okay. I'm not saying that that's, you let yourself down. As I mentioned before, the real value of what you're doing is how it will form your life from your earliest training. I know some of the kids, gymnastics, what have you, swimming started, 5, 6 years old. And by the time they're 20, they may have 15 years of doing that. So, yes, it helps form your life. Hang around with good people. Teaches you, obviously, the value of work, hard work, etc. So even if you don't make it all the way to the pinnacle, you may be the third fastest person in the world in your event. And that's an accomplishment in itself. Just because you're third and they only take two of the Olympic Games on your team doesn't mean a thing. It means that you've done a great job and you're one of the rare, rare people doing what you do.
Mm-hmm. What impact has your involvement in the Olympic movement had on your life? You've talked a little bit about how you're still involved in the Olympic movement now, but what other impact would you say being an Olympian has had on your life?
Well, it's something you always carry with you. I really don't talk about it very much, but it usually gets around to your circle of friends or acquaintances or business associates that you were an Olympian. And of course, lots of stories are about that. A lot of people inquire about things you're asking and how it did affect your life. And to that extent, that's how it has affected my life. It smoothed a lot of introductions and made people curious and, I think, more interested than they might normally be.
Mm. In terms of the cultural and historical significance of the 68 Games, what, in your opinion, would be the legacy of the 1968 U.S. Olympic team?
Well, the legacy is kind of, I think, is kind of obvious. It had an awful lot to do with the protests at the time, where our country was politically. But my personal opinion is I just didn't think that was the proper venue to air your gripes.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of other ways to do it, and we should keep the Olympics what they're supposed to be. I actually have some trepidation about all the money that's gone to the Olympics, and a lot of the people involved in it are literally professional athletes. And I don't think that's what it was made for, but that's what it is. So that's my personal opinion about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that leads into my last question. I was going to ask you about amateurism. You've already talked about the differences between being an amateur in 68 versus now and what your thoughts and feelings are on that. Do you have anything else to add to that?
No, it just makes, it just changes the quality of the competition and the quality of the competition around the world. There's this huge, the Olympic Games originally were meant to be a goodwill thing. 2,000 years ago with the Greeks, etc., it was meant to stop wars, to build goodwill between countries, that kind of thing. And hopefully there's still some of that quality left in it, but unfortunately there's an awful lot of commercialism with it that distorts those original aims and goals.
Mm.
And that's what it is. So I understand that.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we wrap up the interview, is there anything else that you'd like to tell us about?
Um, Well, I guess there's really nothing specific. You kind of covered, you know, my personal opinions and the general air of the times. And it certainly formed a big part of my life, and I'm certainly glad that did it. And I would encourage any athletes, youth, to pursue their goals and keep them clean and keep them pure.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like good advice.
I appreciate your putting this whole thing together. It's nice to have a couple of thousand people's opinion about a worldwide event, and to have a legacy of that particular event recorded somewhere that people a couple of hundred years from now can see, hey, our thoughts are probably the same as theirs.
That's true. Well, thank you, Dean, for being so generous with your time and memories. We very much appreciate it.
Well, good luck. What kind of, is there going to be a publication of this somehow, or